Today is Tuesday, June 26. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, world stocks plunge as fears of a trade war escalate. President Trump says people entering the U.S. illegally should be deported and not allowed to back up the U.S. legal system.
The laws are obsolete. The laws are horrible having to do with the border, both in terms of security and in terms of taking care of people.
Also ahead, a powerful new documentary about a group of inmates working to heal their lives. It's all on today's International Edition. U.S. and European markets fell on Monday as the prospect of a trade war deepened worries across the globe. U.S. stocks fell more than 1% at the end of the day, while European markets were down even more. The U.S., which has already imposed tariffs on steel and aluminum imports, is scheduled to start raising duties on more than $30 billion in Chinese products in 2 weeks. China has promised to retaliate immediately. On Sunday, President Trump issued a warning to U.S. trading partners that unless they remove restrictions placed on American goods, they'll face even more reciprocity from the U.S. And on Monday, Trump criticized Harley-Davidson after the company announced it would move U.S. production of motorcycles for European Union customers overseas to avoid European retaliatory tariffs. Joining us now to discuss is Austin Goolsbee, who is the former chair of the Economics Council under the Obama administration. So what is your reaction to Harley-Davidson's announcement, and will we see more like this?
Yeah, look, this is what happens if you start slapping tariffs on people's products and then the countries start responding. That's why all the economists are holding their heads. No, don't start a trade war, because they tend to spiral in a way that you can't always predict. So it's a bummer out here in the Midwest for Harley-Davidson if they start shifting production. But they're just one company. And, you know, if we start putting $50 billion, $100 billion, now we've heard quotes of $200 billion of tariffs on $200 billion of goods, we're going to feel it. Those countries are going to notice. And when they start responding, we're going to notice. So I think this is not a great moment for the U.S. economy, certainly for the U.S. manufacturers of, call them signature products, that are going to be obvious targets in any kind of a battle. And that includes farmers, manufacturers, a lot of stuff like that.
When you say we'll start to feel it, what do you mean? How will we start to feel it?
Well, we've already started to feel it. If you're working in business, where the first thing you're going to see is that the prices of a bunch of things start going up. So U.S. steel prices are up maybe 15%. They're the highest in many, many years. And that's the direct result of if you start putting in tariffs, then the price of things goes up. So we will feel it in our wallets when we go to the store, and more specifically, people who are working at these companies, they're going to start to feel it because you're going to see production shifting somewhere else. You're going to see companies that use the global supply chain saying, and you already saw this with steel. Steel companies actually sell steel, but they also buy a lot of steel. So then they say, wait, we didn't get an exemption, so we're going to actually have to shut down our production line because now the cost of our inputs went way up. So I think the employees in these prominent industries are also going to feel it.
Would you say we are now in an all-out trade war?
I wouldn't, because mostly we've just had threats. And if this served as kind of a catalyst that the president threatening them put $200 billion, and then they said, if you put $200 billion on us, we'll put $200 billion on you, but it led them to behind the scenes come to some agreement, then fine. You know, you could come up with a situation that was even better than the one we're in. The thing that I'm afraid of is I don't think that's actually what's happening. And I think the administration appears not to have studied the history of the trade agreements of the World Trade Organization or of any of those things, of how hard it was to get all the tariffs reduced around the world for U.S. products that we did. We actually, in most of these trade agreements, got other countries to cut their tariffs dramatically more than the U.S. cut its tariffs. And it would be worth remembering that when we're threatening to go rip up everything and throw it into garbage, is that if we return to a world that existed in, say, 1950, that was a world that was way less favorable for the U.S. producers than the one we're in today. And so we definitely need to think through our strategy better than we're currently doing. And the example that I'll give you is, I think the president is correct to be concerned about Chinese violations of U.S. intellectual property, if you want to call it that way. If you don't want to use the fancy term for it, there are Chinese companies that the Chinese government forces U.S. companies that want to sell in China to have a Chinese partner, and the Chinese partner steals the plans and then commences becoming a competitor, making a competing product. Okay, that's a big problem. If you want to address that problem, it's not, Donald Trump is not the first president to think about that and try to address it. But the effective way to do it is to line up all your allies and go as a group and try to force a change in their behavior. But we haven't formed a group. We've ticked off all of our allies on that.
All right. Well, coming up, we'll hear more from Austin Goolsbee on the impacts of a full-blown trade war. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. North Korea limits family reunions. Indonesia issues death penalty to a cleric for ISIS ties. Trump cites Middle East progress, but he's mum on a peace plan. And the Ethiopia conflict is disrupting schooling. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. We continue now our conversation with Austin Goolsbee, the economics professor at the University of Chicago's Booth School of Business, and he formerly served as the chair of the Council of Economic Advisors as a member of the cabinet of President Barack Obama. So you were saying an ideal strategy would be to form a coalition with our allies over issues of China's unfair trade policies, but because of our tariffs on our allies, that would be a challenge.
So we're going to simultaneously threaten a fight with Canada, with Mexico, with Germany, with the rest of the EU, with Japan, and with Korea. And then we're turning and saying, now we're going to try to force China to do what we want. I think at this point, it's dramatically more likely that China goes to our allies and convinces our own allies to join China in filing a grievance against the United States than it is the other way around. And I kind of can't believe that I'm saying that, because historically that would never be true. Obviously, our own allies would be with us against the infractions the Chinese are doing. But we've opened the door for China in a way that threatens to be quite detrimental to U.S. national interests.
Because it would appear that this policy has the potential to fall apart dramatically. But we have an administration or a president that does not like to admit mistakes. It would seem more like he would rather dig in just to prove he's right, even if he isn't. So where does that leave us?
I hope that's not their mentality. We have seen numerous examples over the last year and a half, in which President Trump has tweeted out a policy that upon further examination or finding out that it's unpopular, they just kind of don't end up doing it. So they don't publicly back away or publicly say, oh, we were wrong. They just kind of don't proceed. And I guess my hope is that they do that. If this remained a small skirmish over some particular industry, the U.S. put in a tariff on whatever, on this special rolled steel, the Chinese responded by some specific thing, and it never went any more than that. The U.S. economy is so massive, is extremely resilient, that wouldn't be the start of a trade war, that we wouldn't be talking about a recession. That it would be limited in nature. And we have done that in the past in the U.S. without too much detriment. If we can't contain it, if we can't stop the president from saying, you know, I'm going to do $50 billion, and then they say, well, then we're going to do $50 billion. And then the president tweets out, well, then I'm going to do $100, and then they said $100, then $200, then they'll do $200. If we can't stop that dynamic, then I really have some significant fears for the U.S. economy, but for the whole world economy, because you cannot have a shooting war, shooting trade war between the two largest economies of the world, or the three largest, if you want to count the U.S., China, and Europe. If those three big groups are going to be in an outright trade war, we will have a global recession. And I think you see the stock market reacting negatively over and over again in the U.S. whenever they perceive that the president is actually serious about starting a trade war, because the business people know that nobody wins a trade war, that what we can do is really destroy the growth for everybody. So hopefully we will have leveler heads prevail.
All right. Austin Goolsbee, he formerly served as the chair of the Council of Economic Advisors under the Obama administration. We appreciate your expertise. Thank you for being with us. The United States top border enforcement official acknowledging Monday that authorities are currently not able to carry out the Trump administration's zero tolerance policy of detaining and prosecuting everyone entering the country illegally, as officials work to develop a policy that would allow prosecutions without family separations. President Trump on Monday again assailed judicial review for illegal border crossers, contending that the migrants ought to immediately be sent back to their homelands.
We're appointing 145 judges here, and everyone goes through this extreme vetting process. We're talking about 5,000. Where do you find 5,000 people to be judges? And you know what it leads? It leads to graft. It leads to a lot of other things.
His latest comments echoing his thoughts Sunday when he first called for ending judicial review of asylum claims, saying, when somebody comes in, we must immediately, with no judges or court cases, bring them back from where they came. White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders at Monday's briefing to reporters defended the president's statements.
Just because you don't see a judge doesn't mean you aren't receiving due process. The president is focused on securing our borders and reforming our immigration system to prevent the crisis at the border from getting worse.
Joining us now to discuss the legal and constitutional viability of these ideas is Los Angeles-based immigration attorney Ashkan Amami. Thank you for being with us. Is it legal to change this policy and not give persons due process?
Absolutely not. This is an issue that was resolved over a century ago in the late 1800s, and even Supreme Court cases where it's almost unequivocally clear that any person within our borders, legal or illegal, has the right to due process. The argument against due process for illegal immigrants comes down to the interpretation of the word person, because the court cases make it very clear that any person within our borders is subject to due process. However, I don't know how it can be argued that an illegal immigrant is not a person. That just seems to be really a far reach.
So would you say that's just more bluster coming from the president, or do you think he could actually try to implement something like that? And what kind of legal ramifications would that have?
I mean, there's so much precedent against his position that I cannot imagine that he would be successful. If the court really, really took a very extreme stance, obviously, conservatives have a majority in the Supreme Court, and anything is possible, but I can't imagine there being any legally sound basis for upholding this policy if it ever gets to the Supreme Court. I know that it's already met with a lot of resistance from Republicans and Democrats, from legal scholars. For lawyers, it's very, very clear what the policy is. I mean, and as I said, there's been over a century of case law supporting the fact that anyone within our borders, even terrorists, are subject to due process.
The president also tweeted, most children come without parents. Is that the case?
It's really hard to say how many children actually come without parents. But I think the point of that comment is to take away from the focus on these children have been separated from their parents. That's what people are really wanting to talk about. And to say that most children come without their parents is to sort of try to diminish the sort of outrage towards the separations that have occurred. Based on what we've been hearing, about 45 kids are separated from their parents every single day at the border. So whether there's children coming without their parents doesn't change the fact that the children who are here with their parents are being taken away from them. It doesn't change the fact that kids are crying themselves to sleep in detention centers. It doesn't change the fact that an immigrant killed themselves because they were separated from their child. None of these things change based on this tweet that some children may come here without their parents. It's completely irrelevant.
We are also learning that before implementing the family separation policies at the border, the administration had pulled the limited funding supporting organizations that provide free, low-cost legal representation to unaccompanied children, meaning many of the orgs providing free and low-cost legal rep to these kids had to stop taking new cases right before over 2,000 kids were pushed into the system. Do they now have any recourse? These kids obviously have nothing, no money. Does that mean a child of any age, including one that may not even be able to speak yet, has to literally represent themselves?
Even under the Obama administration, these organizations at the border helping detained immigrants were under a lot of pressure. They were overworked, not enough resources. Thankfully, now, after the lid was blown off of the separation of the children from their parents, a lot of people have come to donate money to a lot of these organizations who are basically going to the detention centers, trying to represent these children and their parents, trying to get them reunited. And I think that these organizations have raised exponentially more in the past months than they had in the previous 5 to 10 years, just because of all the attention that's been brought to this issue. So on the one hand, yes, I can imagine that the administration is doing nothing to help these organizations. But on the other hand, I think that private citizens are stepping up to help these organizations take matters into their own hands.
Los Angeles-based immigration attorney Ashkan Amami, thanks for being with us. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan was declared the winner in a tightly contested ballot on Sunday. And as Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul, this victory could continue to give the leader immense power for years to come.
The president's grip on power was strengthened further in simultaneous parliamentary elections. Erdogan's AKP party is set to continue to control parliament, although it will need the support of the nationalist MHP party, which it formed an electoral alliance with during the election. The pro-Kurdish HDP party, accused by Erdogan of being terrorist, also entered parliament, becoming the second largest opposition party. Erdogan's comprehensive victory came as most opinion polls indicating a far closer contest. Erdogan, with his new presidential powers and a new electoral mandate, is widely seen to be more powerful than ever. Dorian Jones of VOA News, Istanbul.
And you're listening to International Edition on VOA.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
VOA's International Edition continues now. A new critically acclaimed documentary, The Work, is set in a single room in Folsom Prison in California. Set inside a single room, the three men from the outside participate in a four-day group therapy retreat with level four convicts. Over the 4 days, each man takes his turn at delving deep into his past.
Zimbabwe. Zimbabwe.
Well, the film offers a powerful and rare look inside prison walls and brings a light to a wide range of issues relevant to prison reform and healing. Joining us now is former inmate Manny Ruiz and the film's director, Jarius McCleary. So let's start with you, Jarius. What made you decide to do this documentary?
I didn't know anything about documentary, except I loved watching documentary, but I was working in Los Angeles in the independent film industry. I kept coming to this circle, and I kept volunteering for years, and it got to be a point I saw other men try and start a documentary about what this program was, and it just got to a point where I think myself and my brothers, we decided that we might be able to do it.
Manny, how did you come to join this, and tell me a little bit about why you decided it was something that would be good for you? Or you thought you'd at least try it?
You know, I had heard of, vaguely about a men's group, and I had no idea what it meant. And I asked Pat one time about it, exactly that. I said, well, what is it that you guys do in there? What is this men's group? And he said, well, why don't you come and find out? And I got a permission slip to go to this chapel for a men's support group on a Sunday, and I guess I'll go see what it is. And the very first time that I walked in there, there was about 15, 20 men, like they were older, they're from different races, not my own people. What they just did was they spoke individually, and they spoke openly and without fear of judgment. It was basically a talking circle.
In what ways did it impact you as a human being and your experience in prison and potentially helping you move forward to a life outside of prison?
What I always felt like is I had a belt cinched around my chest. And when I went to this group and I heard people speaking their truth and I felt that I could speak my truth, it felt like that belt was released. And I was able to breathe. So what that allowed me to do was become authentic, was to discover what it was inside myself, that it was okay, that I had whatever I thought and felt, and I could be okay with being who I was. And that's something that I wasn't able to do for my entire life up until that point.
It sounds like it really had a profound impact on you.
From that first time I went to that circle, I stayed for the next 14 years. And the only reason why I was no longer in the circle is because I got transferred. I help other people find their truth and facilitate with doing the work for someone to be authentic and touch with their feelings and work through their wounds, emotional wounds and traumas from their past. So it continues because it keeps myself in check. It keeps me grounded and it makes me better at decision-making based on what I feel when I'm in touch with what I feel.
Jairus, it looks like some of what you've written about it, one sentence that really stands out here is what I'd like people to take away from the work is that we are more than the worst thing we've ever done and we are more alike than we are different. That's a pretty deep statement.
My dad started doing this emotional work on the outside when I was like 16, and he came home and he just sat down on the couch and started crying and he started telling me the truth about what he felt and who he was, that he didn't know how to be a dad. His dad never really gave him the things that he needed to feel like he knew what it was, what he was supposed to do as a father. And so it was like a collaboration that started between his sons and my mom. So we basically started to talk about the process of sort of growing together and what our relationships were. And so he started doing this work. He would ask me to do it with him. We would go and do different types of workshops on the outside. Essentially, he asked me to go, and I had all these unconscious conceptions and judgments about what I thought prison was.
Mm.
I saw television shows, I saw the news, and I'd never been there, and I was afraid to go. So he asked me to go to this group, and I said no. And I said no twice before I said yes, third time. I had all these preconceived notions about what I thought it was about. When I got there, I saw men telling the truth in a way that was so real and so visceral. I'd never seen anything like it. And it just gave me the courage to do the same. And I kept going back because it was the most powerful thing I'd ever seen. If that kind of healing could take place in what I conceptually thought was one of the worst places you could go to, and that kind of magic was happening there on the inside, that it was just, you have no excuse. I don't have an excuse not to do that. And it gave me the courage to do it.
What made you decide to have people from the outside participate in the group?
Well, that's what the group does. I think it was Pat's dream to have men from the inside and men from the outside. And he didn't really know about group therapy, so to speak. He'd read things. It seemed like what he wanted to do for the last 100,000 years, men would come home from the hunt and they'd sat around a fire and just talk. And he's like, I think we could do that. So he wanted men from the inside and men from the outside to sit together. People bring what they bring to the circle, and everything that they bring is necessary. You start telling the truth and talking about certain things that have happened to you, things that maybe you've never talked to anybody else about ever, and it resonates with two or three people in a group, and suddenly you have people chiming in and basically giving you confirmation things that you've gone through.
Right. And such diverse backgrounds between some of the men from the outside and some that are on the inside.
In reality, Rob Obie said something to me, which I think is true. Pain is pain. It doesn't matter where you're from. Mm-hmm. Once everybody had a mother, everybody had a father, you have some of these similar experiences, and you might have done different things and made different choices after those experiences. But I think we all have some of the same experiences when you get right down to it.
It's the humanity, right, Manny?
That word has been used a lot when it comes to talk about what I've discovered is I've gotten back in touch with my humanity. And when I'm in touch with my humanity, I can relate with the humanity and everybody else with it.
All right. Well, we thank you both for telling your story. You can watch the documentary The Work on demand on YouTube. And finally, tonight, former President George H.W. Bush, who just recently lost his wife, Barbara Bush, former First Lady Barbara Bush, is welcoming a new member of the family, a yellow Labrador retriever named Sully. The 94-year-old and his service dog got acquainted Monday at the Bush compound on the coast in Maine. Sully had been trained by America's Vet Dogs, a nonprofit that provides service dogs. A Bush spokesperson says the dog can open doors, pick up items, and summon help. But more than anything, the dog is a wonderful companion. A photo sent via Twitter shows Sully lounging at the feet of Bush and former President Bill Clinton, who had been visiting Monday. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. We thank you for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, John Ellison. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The U.S. India State and Urban Initiative, led by the Center for Strategic and International Studies, Wadhwani Chair in U.S. India Policy Studies, and the CSIS Energy and National Security Program, recently announced three new projects with the state government of Maharashtra, India, as part of the initiative's ongoing work. CSIS has been the implementing partner of the U.S. Department of State in carrying out the initiative since September 2016. The goal of the U.S. India State and Urban Initiative is to build productive energy partnerships between Indian and United States subnational entities, such as state governments, cities, industry, research institutions, and civil society. Under this initiative, the government of Maharashtra and the California-based Network for Global Innovation will sign an agreement to develop a clean tech incubator ecosystem in Maharashtra to accelerate adoption of sustainable technologies and encourage growth of trade and investment of these technologies. The Georgia Institute of Technology will launch a new pilot research project to understand the consumer dynamics and consumers' responsiveness to adoption of new technologies in the electricity sector in Maharashtra. The city of Pune in Maharashtra was recognized as India's first lighthouse city as a result of a Grand Challenge competition lost in 2017 by the National Institution for Transforming India and Colorado-based Rocky Mountain Institute. A lighthouse city has demonstrated that it has smart urban development with population density of greater than 1 million that needs diverse modes of passenger transportation. The Lighthouse City is supported by an urban mobility lab that will be initially hosted by the Pune Municipal Corporation starting in August 2018. The lab will advance the design, integration, and implementation of new solutions for complex transportation challenges, as well as how these ideas can be replicated and scaled throughout India. The goal is to demonstrate ways to upgrade transportation services to meet the needs of rapidly growing cities while showing operational efficiency and reduction of pollution, congestion, and petroleum demand. These announcements were made during the visit of Sri Devendra Fudnavis, Honorable Chief Minister of Maharashtra, to Washington, D.C., when he attended a public forum on June 14th, co-hosted by the CSIS Wadhwani Chair and the India Initiative at Georgetown University to outline his vision for the state of Maharashtra. The initiative strongly supports U.S. government policy to promote energy security, economic development, and energy sector reform in India. The United States is proud to work with India and with private sector partners to help India achieve its ambitious energy goals.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.